Well, good evening, everyone. Good to see those who are here. So tonight, we have, for those who may be visiting, we've just started a discussion in the last week and a half of the miracles of Christ. And tonight we are dealing with the healing of the nobleman's son. And this is found in John, the fourth chapter, and we'll begin at verse 43 through the end of the chapter. Let's go ahead and read that here, and then we'll have some discussion on it. And when I say discussion, that is an invitation, please. I don't want it to be a one-way thing, but please feel free to interject, give some ideas about anything that ideas you might have, or clarifications that you might have, so we can understand these words a little bit better. So beginning in verse 43, "Now after the 2 days he departed from there and went to Galilee. For Jesus himself testified that a prophet has no honor in his own country. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans received him, having seen all the things he did in Jerusalem at the feast, for they also had gone to the feast. So Jesus came again to Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water wine, and there was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum. When he heard that Jesus had come out of Judea into Galilee, he went to him and implored him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Then Jesus said to him, 'Unless you people see signs and wonders, you will by no means believe.' The nobleman said to him, 'Sir, come down before my child dies.' Jesus said to him, 'Go your way, your son lives.' So the man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him, and he went his way. And as he was now going down, his servants met him and told him, saying, 'Your son lives.' Then he inquired of him the hour when he got better. And they said to him, 'Yesterday, at the seventh hour, the fever left him.' So the father knew that it was at the same hour in which Jesus said to him, 'Your son lives.' And he himself believed, and his whole household. This again is the second sign Jesus did when he had come out of Judea into Galilee." Now, before we get into the miracle itself and trying to split it apart and dissect it and find meaning in all of this, there's one passage that kind of stands out and which really I don't think has any bearing or relevance, so much relevance to the topic here of the healing, and that is in verse 44. And I would greatly appreciate hearing some comments on this as to the explanation or what this means. I've read a couple of different things, and I don't think that whichever explanation you accept, it has a great bearing on what we read or what follows it. But in verse 44, "For Jesus himself testified that a prophet has no honor in his own country." What do you think is meant by this? Any ideas? I can give you a couple of them, but go ahead.
Well, the first thing I think of, what I've always thought this is meant, that you know, Jesus was familiar to the, this is not this the carpenter's son, they said, well, you might say that here, you know, the son of Joseph.
We think you're thinking
brothers.
Of Luke.
Yeah,
Luke.
We know his brothers. We know all these people. And I think that the point is that, well, this, he can't be anything. He can't be anything special. He's just a carpenter, mm-hmm. the son of a carpenter.
Right, right.
And so he doesn't have any honor because of the familiarity.
Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?
Well, there you go. That's another thing, too. That is similar to one explanation I got that I've read. And if you will remember, if I can direct you over to Luke, the fourth chapter. And I don't want to belabor the point here too much, but in the interest of time. Luke, the fourth chapter, in verse 16 through 24. If I wrote that down right. Okay, this is in reference to something else. So hold that just a minute. One explanation is that when he says a prophet has no honor in his own country, he's not specifically talking about that huge region which we see up there, Galilee. I mean, we think of a country as, you know, somewhat defined borders and everything, but back in those days, it's more of a region. He wasn't talking about that region, but more Nazareth, his city. And this particular passage in Luke 4 corresponds to another passage where it says he went to his country, but here specifically he says he came to Nazareth. And what had happened to him in Nazareth? They had threatened to kill him there, hadn't they? Yeah, they were ready. What you were saying, you know, is this the carpenter's son? Why is he saying all these things? And they were plotting to kill him. So he didn't hold any honor in his own country, in his own city. So that is one explanation. Another, and that goes along too with something you said, Frank, about nothing good comes out of Nazareth. So certainly there wasn't anything of honor there if you claim to be from Nazareth. Another explanation that I've read is that Jesus did not want to, we'll see that he's up to this point, he's kind of created a little bit of excitement. He's starting to become known for some of his actions and some of the things that he accomplished. So his reputation was sort of preceding him. And he thought if he went back into Galilee, he didn't want to create a big uproar and division among the Pharisees and all that sort of thing. This is another explanation I've got. So by going back into Galilee, he wouldn't create such an uproar because he maybe wasn't as well known there. Of course, the problem with that explanation is we see how the Galileans treated him when he got there. They were very glad to see him. They received him. But some would argue that, well, it wasn't that big of a reception. So I just wanted to get that out because it kind of puzzled me what might be meant by that, and wanted to hear if anyone else had any more thoughts about that.
In Luke, it says no prophet. And you know that in the Old Testament, for the most part, whenever the prophets were doing their work, most people didn't pay them any attention either.
That's right. We were just discussing some of the minor prophets and Joel and you know, their condemnation of some of the things that the countries around here. They didn't pay him any attention. Well, they did listen to Jonah for a while, but then we see what happened to the Ninevites. So, yeah, that's another good point to bring up there. Okay, so is this the second specific sign or miracle that Jesus performed? And we studied on Sunday, and we read a couple of chapters earlier about the wedding feast at Cana. So, and then we get down, and it's kind of misleading at first. In fact, it kind of threw me off at the end of that chapter, the last verse. I can get back over here. I had it marked. And it says, this was the second miracle. Hang on, I'll be there in just a second. Yeah, the last verse there, if I can get to it. Sorry, I thought I had it marked there. This again is the second sign Jesus did when he had come out of Judea into Galilee. So that, you know, if you glance at that, as I did, you think, okay, this is the second miracle he performed. Was it the second miracle? No, it wasn't. Because if you read the chapters before this, you will see that, no, there were some other things. This is only the second one that John recorded here. And by the way, John doesn't go real heavy into recording Jesus' miracles. In fact, just seven of them that he records. And we'll talk about that a little bit further. So, but that's a good segue into our discussion as to, you know, I always like to do the five W's, who, what, when, where, that sort of thing. So where was Jesus at this point? Where do we read that he was just coming back into?
Cana.
He is coming back to Cana. Coming back. So that means he had been doing something. What was he doing? And where? Where had he been? And this involves reading a few chapters. You know, chapters 2 and 3.
Samaria.
Well, he was coming out of Samaria. But he had even been further than that. What had he just attended? What had they heard about him? I think it says there. that, yeah, he had been down in Jerusalem, down at the Passover feast, and now he's on his way back and coming back to Cana. This trip, I think I read it's about roughly 180 miles, so it's a pretty arduous journey. Was this an uneventful trip? Had gone pretty smoothly for him? Got down there in Jerusalem and went to Passover and came on home, right? No, it didn't quite work out like that, did he? Had a few little incidents of note along the way on the journey. Something about, I believe, some money changers at the temple he had a little bit of a disagreement with. Created a little bit of a stir and uproar there, didn't he? Okay. And I'm not going to get into all of them, but he also talked with this man, Nicodemus. Kind of confused Nicodemus there a little bit. What do you mean I got to be born again? So he had to square that away. Then the first part of this chapter, rather lengthy discussion on him and a woman at the well in Samaria, a Samaritan woman. Wow. Jews didn't have anything to do with the Samaritans. And I won't go into the long history of it or anything, but there was some bad blood there and they just did not associate with them. But that, again, would tell us something about the nature of Christ too, the fact that he is communicating or having discussion with this woman. Not just that the things that he said, but the fact that he was even having a discussion with her. So, yes. He had created, I don't want to call it a stir, but he had created some excitement. And we know that this wasn't the first second miracle that he had performed because, John, for one thing, mentions toward the end of his writing in John 20 and verse 30 that he performed a whole bunch of miracles which weren't all recorded in this book. And he explains the reason why he performed these miracles. And we'll have a discussion about that too, hopefully. But it said that in John, the second chapter, a couple of chapters before this, in verse 23, now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover during the feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs which he did. So he was performing miracles before he got back into Galilee and Canaan. So as I said, people were starting to know about him, and his reputation had really preceded him. So some of these folks, in particular, this other gentleman, which we'll talk about here, probably had heard about him, which brings us into the who. Who are our characters? Who are our players here? Aren't too many of them. So we got a couple of primary players. We got Jesus. Yep. Got the nobleman. Okay. And that's really the only ones who have any speaking parts in this little presentation here. But we call it the healing of the nobleman's son. But he plays an important part too here, the son. So, but it's a secondary part. And I like the term that Rick uses. It might be the healing of the nobleman's son, and the miracle may have surrounded him, but he's kind of a vessel, a vehicle to carry the story along a little bit. Doesn't play a major important part other than he was very sick. But let's talk about this nobleman here. And I looked up the term nobleman, as it's used here, the Greek term. And the Greek term, and I know nothing about Greek, the Greek word is basilikos, and it is translated as a royal official. Now, a little bit of trivia for you here. I always like to pass on these little factoids. If basilikos sounds like basilica, it's because there is a connection. Those of you familiar with Asheville, we've got the Basilica of St. Lawrence right in the downtown. Well, what's the connection between royalty and a religious site? Well, the term, of course, comes from the Greek, And a basilica was a type of building used in the Athenian royal portico. And then Rome adopts that style and used that building style in their halls of justice, which later on were appropriated as churches. And then that became the standard plan for a lot of the new churches. So that's how we get the religious aspect or connection with the basilica. But really, it should convey the idea of nobility, of royalty. We don't know too much about this person other than it says he is a nobleman. We can make some assumptions about that he was probably a person of great esteem, who had connections. And beyond that, the identity is not known. Some have thought that he might have been Chusa, the steward of King Herod, which we read about in Luke 8:3, or also in Acts 13:1, we see a reference to Manaen. In fact, let me just flip over that real quick, and you can see where that connection might have come up. Acts 13:1, now in the church that was at Antioch, there were certain prophets and teachers, Barnabas and Simeon, who was called Niger, Lucius of Cyrene, and Manaen, who had been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch and Saul. So we can't say with any surety who this was. That's just pure speculation. But just accept the fact that this person was of nobility. He was a member of the royal, he was connected in some way to the royal court, which tells me that he had a lot of things at his disposal. And by a lot of things, I mean healthcare professionals, physicians. He could probably afford or knew somebody who knew somebody, had connections to get the best care that was available at the time for his son. Now, I don't want to say the medical care at that time was primitive, but by today's standards, we would consider it primitive. But in a lot of ways, they weren't as primitive as you think. We read a lot about different oils. We did read different balms and other references to different plants and things that they used. Well, that sounds like, you know, something that, yeah, that's I'd rather go get something over the counter. Well, a lot of our medicines came from those natural sources. You take aspirin, for instance. That came from the bark of a willow tree. People used to give them bark of willow to the bark from a willow tree as a pain reliever, as an antiseptic. So, yes, he probably had tried everything at that point to relieve the son's fever. We don't know what he was suffering from. But it doesn't sound like this was a fever that would pass in a few days. I doubt that it was anything highly contagious. Otherwise, as we see here later, it could have been. And maybe the other people were just incubating, I don't know. But we see that the nobleman was in pretty good shape and made this journey down from Capernaum. If you look at the, if I can get this right up here at the top of the Sea of Galilee, down to Cana. That's about, I've read anywhere from 16 to 20 miles, but it's not an easy journey. That's a day's journey. So he was in pretty good shape, and we see later on, his servants, his household seemed to be in relatively good health. So it doesn't sound like it was a contagious disease that the son was suffering from. It could have been some, and it doesn't sound like it was, you know, a 24-hour type of bug. Something that this person was at the point of death. So much so that I'm quite sure that the nobleman had exhausted all other resources to try and find some cure for his son. And now his son, with certainty, was going to die. He may have had something. He could have had an appendix rupture. He could have had some type of meningitis, something that was deadly, and he was dying. and there seemed to be no hope for him. So the nobleman comes to Jesus, and perhaps he had heard about Jesus. As I said, his reputation seemed to precede him before he got back to Galilee. Do you think, here's another question for you, do you think that he was acting, the nobleman came to Jesus out of desperation? Or do you think he came out of faith, out of a belief? You know, that there was no hope except, I got this one thing left here, I'll go see if he can do something. Or do you think there was a bud of faith there? A little bit.
Any thoughts? He had faith that Jesus could heal his son, no doubt, because he'd heard of Jesus, and he went right straight to him.
Yep. Okay, any other thoughts?
I mean, it's both. There's desperation on his part.
I think there was definitely desperation. And like you said, and like Frank said, there had to be a little bit of faith there. Otherwise, if I didn't believe this person could help my son, yes, as I said, he probably heard about the miracles and other things, but I didn't think that this person could help my son, and my son is on death's door, I'm not going to leave him. I'm going to be there when his hour comes, not be a day's travel away. So I feel like that there was, you know, at least a smidgen of faith there. And I think this is an important lesson for us to hear about the power of faith, or at least having faith. And I don't feel like I'm giving away anything, or this is not a spoiler alert, because I'll be teaching on it in another month. But there's another parable. That's kind of a sidebar to a main parable about the woman with a blood flow problem. And he turns to her after she had touched the hem of his garment, and he tells her that her faith had healed her. In Matthew 9:22, Jesus turned about, and when he saw her, he said, "Daughter, be of good comfort, thy faith hath made thee whole." And the woman was made whole from that hour. So, now this begs another question. Which comes first? And as we read and toward the end of John, that Christ performed a lot of miracles to increase people's belief that they might have faith. And we've talked about that being a reason for these miracles. But which came first then? Did the faith come first, or did the miracle come first? And I see Zach's got his finger up back there.
In this case, you can definitely question how much faith he had because of Jesus saying in verse 48, which sounds critical, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. Mm-hmm. And then after he was healed, and verse 53, it says, the father knew that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, your son will live. And he himself believed in all his household.
Mm-hmm.
So their belief didn't come out until after.
Right. 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 Yeah, I think you can make a case for both. I think he had to have faith before the miracle occurred. But then after the miracle occurred, and yes, it does seem that Christ gave him a mild rebuke there when he said, you know, unless you people see signs and miracles, you're not going to believe.
I almost wonder if Jesus is testing him a little bit. Oh, you want me to heal yourself? Oh, you people, all you care about is a sign. You know, that, and to provoke, perhaps, the response that he got from this individual. Wait, no, please. You know, this is not about that.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure there were a lot of people out there who, they just came for the show, didn't they? And I
think the people, you is plural, at least according to the way the New American Standard reads that. He's not talking to necessarily him as an individual.
Right. He's talking as a whole, in general, that a lot of people are not going to believe unless they see signs and miracles. But yeah, it almost seems like a mild rebuke. But he had to have some faith to come there. I agree with that. And then after he gets back, even had greater conviction, because he knew at that point, when he found out what time his son had, when the fever had left his son, that this was the same time when Jesus said, your child lives. So yes, and you know, it seems like there was a little bit of desperation, because you know, again, after Jesus says to him, and maybe he felt like Jesus was just, nah, I'm not going to bother with that one today. You know, when he says, you people won't believe unless you see signs and wonders. But then he pleaded with them again. He said, sir, come down, as we see in verse 49, come down before my child dies. So, yeah, a little bit of desperation there. He's not sure that, you know, there's a miracle going on here. But it's interesting to me how the nobleman, remember this is royalty now, or he's a person of some esteem, how does he address Jesus there? Or do you want to make another comment?
Yeah, he's talking about his belief after it happens. He shows belief going to see, desperation to go see. I've heard of this guy, let's go see, I'm desperate. He gets there and he asks, and he doesn't receive the answer he's expecting.
Right.
And so he asks again, please come down.
But he had respect for Jesus.
It sounds like the centurion, I believe it was. You don't have to come. Just speak the word. Here he spoke the word. So your child is alive. Mm-hmm. The guy believed him. Because he didn't keep, come on, you got to come lay your hands on me. Said, okay, you said, I believe you. I have faith in your word. I hope I'm headed back home.
True.
So is the faith, a desperate faith, a believing faith, and then faith based on evidence.
Yeah.
It grows, three steps here, basically.
Yeah. And when he found out that his child actually was alive and the fever had left him at that same time, that reinforced his faith there, didn't it? And we'll get into some of the ripple effects here too. And you brought up something now, I forgot what I was going to make a comment about, but I'll get to it. Now, back to how he addressed him, you know, when he seemed like maybe he was put away at first. He said, sir, come before my child dies. And what did you say, Frank? Why would this nobleman address a carpenter's son, somebody out of Nazareth, why would he call him sir?
Out of respect.
He recognized something here in this person. There was a respect. And I looked up the Greek word that was translated here. I know here in the South, we call everybody, if we're, you know, we've been brought up right, we refer to everyone as sir and ma'am. It's just being polite. But this term that he used is translated also as Lord or Master. So he's using more, he's not just being polite. He is using an honorific term to address Christ. He realized Christ's nobility, or that Christ, his status superseded what his was, the nobleman's was. So he wasn't just being desperate or being polite and saying, sir, but he recognized the power that Christ had at that time, or had faith in what Christ had. So he's been told, your son lives, he departs, and he heads back to his home up in Capernaum, and it's about 20 miles away, and he gets there and he's greeted by his servants. Again, indicating that, you know, this nobleman, he was a person of some wealth, that he had these people who could take care of him and serve him. He's greeted by these noblemen, and they tell him that his son was alive. What a relief that was. But then, what time did it happen? What did he say? Seventh hour, which according to the Rick Harrington clock we saw in this chart, would have been 1 o'clock in the afternoon. In fact, I've got one old Bible version that actually says 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So, And I don't know, I mean, there's nothing specific about, well, one cross, you know, the sun's the sun, has nothing to do with it other than to confirm. It could have been the ninth hour. It could have been the sixth hour. It could have been, but it was at the exact hour that Christ had told him, your son lives. So that confirmed to him, here is someone, a son with an illness, and there's no pulling back from this one. There's no way he's dying. He's going to be dead anytime. And it happened at the same time that Christ said, your son lives.
There's an interesting thing there in that he said yesterday set up there. So that tells you how far this official travels to see Jesus and to talk to him about that. He traveled at least a day's journey.
Yeah. That's what I said. You think about, well, to us, 18, 20 miles, that's nothing. Of course, we got paved roads. We got nice internal combustion engines and our electric vehicles, whatever the case may be. But back then, it was a pretty rough trial. And what I have read is this was not an easy route. The Romans were great road builders, and they had built some pretty good roads at that time. But still, travel could be treacherous. And this particular route from Capernaum to Cana was not a straight freeway. It covered over some hills and dales and that sort of thing. So like you were saying, Rick, this was an arduous trip. And it took him a good day to get back home, we see there. So we can see that.
There's an exercise of faith right there.
Yeah, you're reading my mind. That's an exercise in faith that says something, that speaks to this person's faith that he had, that Jesus could deliver his son. Okay, so let's talk about the ripple effects here. He gets back home, and the servants tell him, your son is not dying, the fever has left him, and the father knew that it was the same hour. And then what does it say toward the end of verse 53? And he himself believed, and his whole household. So not only was his faith confirmed, but what happened after that? Did the other say, well, that's nice, good, got her son back? No, that had an effect on them too, didn't it?
And it's interesting that they didn't see the miracle for themselves.
Right.
They had to believe his testimony.
That's true. But I would like to believe that they recognized the dire straits that the son was in, that death was imminent, going to come any time. And then when they started putting all these things together, matching up, they believed in the miracle themselves. Although, even though they hadn't seen Jesus at all, hadn't talked to him, but they believed. Does this make you think of any other situations elsewhere in the Bible? It says, he himself believed in his whole household. I don't know, made me think of a couple of things. Cornelius. Those are the two that came to my mind right away. Cornelius. Now, you could argue, was there a miracle there? Well, yeah, I think there was something divine and supernatural that happened with the visitations by the angels and everything that went on and Peter's trip to him. But it wasn't just Cornelius, was it? It was his household. The Philippian jailer, there definitely was a miracle there, right? And when they talked to the Philippian jailer, was it just the jailer himself who believed, who was converted? No, it was his whole household. So we kind of see the ripple effects, and I think that's a lesson to us too, that our faith should be strong enough, even though we don't have miracles today, but our strength, our faith, and our actions, our words, our deeds should be influential to others around us. Let's see. What else did I have? Okay. So, what is the application here? Is this just a kind of a neat story that sort of reinforces that Jesus was indeed divine, talks to his divinity, that he could perform these miracles? Or is it that John, who only writes about seven miracles, he could have fill up many more chapters, a much longer book, if he wrote all about all these extra miracles and went into detail about them as he does on some of these. But he only picked seven of them. Does that tell you anything? It speaks to me a little bit about maybe he was very selective about which miracles. So, I mean, if I had 100 miracles, well, he healed another person. Yeah, he turned water into wine again, or he did this or did that. You know, okay, that's, I don't want to say it's overkill, but after a while, it's like, oh, seen that before. Or is there some other message in here that he picked out this particular miracle to speak of it, and other miracles too that he wanted to talk about? And I'm sure we all can find, I don't think any right or wrong answer on here, but and that's the beauty of some of these stories in the Bible, that we read them, and then we read them about the 50th time, and we note something new or appeals to us in a different way. Just like Rick was preaching the other day, you know, I had never thought about the other characters in that crucifixion story so much. Yeah, I knew who they were and what they were there. But when you stop and analyze them a little bit, you can take, there are a lot of takeaways that you can get from those sort of things. But, you know, I think that there is more to this than just, okay, confirming to us that Jesus was able to do this in his divinity. And I think the major thing is reinforcement of faith. Not faith that he is divine, but faith that he can heal us spiritually. And we have to have that faith in him. What does Hebrews 11:6 say? But without faith, it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. So we know that if we have faith and put our trust in him, that he can heal us spiritually and reward us. And we know what that final reward is that he's talking about. Also, someone brought it up. Jesus didn't have to be present, did he, at this? No. You know, and I think that's what the nobleman thought. He's got to be present and physically lay his hands on my son for him to be healed. Christ didn't need that, did he? He could transcend any distance there. That was his power. He didn't have to be present. He could do it through indirect methods or over long distances. And the same with us today. That, you know, yes, he is with us, very close to us, but he from on high can heal us and heal our spiritual woes. Any other ideas about this that we could take away from this?
So is the nobleman a Jew or a Gentile?
Well,
Gentile?
It doesn't say. We don't know much about him, but you know, that's a very good question. We can speculate if he was a nobleman, if he was part of Herod's court, he could be a pseudo-Jew, I guess, not a strong practicing Jew, but I think he would. I mean, if you look at Herod, he was sort of along the Jewish lines there.
Well, my only thought is that when Jesus does heal Gentiles, that is specifically brought to our attention. So I wonder if, for that reason, you know, that he might have been a Jew. But
could have been. I don't know. But I did have a note somewhere else. I'm glad you mentioned that. We see the difference between here's a nobleman and here's someone who's a carpenter's son out of Nazareth. And to me, that shows, at first we might think that just judging by these first two miracles we read about, you know, he's sort of at a big wedding feast and someone probably of some esteem was throwing this big wedding feast, and now he's mingling with doing something for the nobleman. Say, well, he's just hanging out with the rich people. No, we see a lot of other instances where he's just all walks of life. whether it's the Samaritan woman, whether it's the cripple, whether it's the lepers, whether it's the nobleman. Everyone's welcome. You know, it talks about how he, well, in Ephesians specifically, it's talking about Jews and Gentiles breaking down that middle wall of partition. But of a truth, I perceive that God is no respecter of person. And we see that in Christ's actions here too, that all walks of life he interacted with and was able to help. Any other comments before bell's about to ring here? Appreciate your comments and your attention.